All right, so we're going to start our new series today, and I want to do 2 Samuel. And we're always like, well, why not do first? Well, I did first with the youth group, and I've never gotten to 2 Samuel, and I really want to teach 2 Samuel. So, you know, when you're the teacher, you get to control those sorts of things, and that's what I'm going to do. So, and 2 Samuel is David's book. You know, 1 Samuel is largely Samuel and Saul. The 2 Samuel is David, and I really want to... We've just finished this great study of the life of Christ, and I think it's a nice kind of segue to go back to the Old Testament and look at David, and this is certainly his book. So what I want to do today as an intro is kind of do a flyby or a drive-by or whatever vehicle you want to take through 1 Samuel very quickly, kind of review what goes on in that book, and then finish up today with 1 Samuel 31, which is going to set the tone or set the events for 2 Samuel chapter 1. And if you jump right into 2 Samuel chapter 1, not knowing what happened in the last chapter of 1 Samuel, you'll be a little bit lost. So I want to make sure we have a full picture of what's going on. And a lot of these stories will be familiar to you. But it's kind of important to make sure that we've got all that. And I want to talk about the purpose of it. So why study David? Well, I mean, it seems kind of goes without saying, right? He serves as the subject of more clauses in Old Testament scripture than any other human being. 638 clauses mention David in the Old Testament. Anybody want to guess who's second? Moses with 554. All right, it's like the home run list. Like this, David's the Hank Aaron. I don't recognize the asterisk. David's like the Hank Aaron of the home run list. God is mentioned obviously way more, but as far as people go, David leads the league. And he also fulfills several major Old Testament prophecies. So we get these prophecies like Genesis 49:10. It says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him." Now ultimately that's fulfilled in Jesus, but it has to start with a Davidic kingdom. Right? It's going to start with David. David is going to be the one where that covenant is instituted by God through his monarchy. Deuteronomy 12:5 says, "But you shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all your tribes to put his name and make his habitation there. There shall you go." Well, that's Jerusalem. Who is the one that conquers Jerusalem? It's David. Okay, David is the one that conquers that city from the Jebusites. He will ultimately not build the temple, but his son will. That will be where God places his name. Okay. Genesis 17:8 says, "And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojourning, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." Now certainly Joshua begins that conquest, but the idea of having a united Israel is fulfilled under David. Okay? And then with Balaam in Numbers 24, this is what he says when he talks about Israel. He says, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be dispossessed. Seir also, his enemy, shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly. And one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of cities." Then he looked on Amalek and took up his discourse and said, "Amalek was the first among the nations, but its end is utter destruction." Well, when we study the life of David, in Numbers 24:7, it said Moab would be destroyed. 2 Samuel 8, David destroys Moab. In Numbers 24:18 and 19, it says Edom will be destroyed. 2 Samuel 8, David goes after Edom. 1 Samuel 30, he destroys the Amalekites, which was the last prophecy we read there in chapter 20. So David is very important in fulfilling a lot of this stuff and being the precursor to the ultimate fulfillment of these promises, which is going to be Jesus, obviously. So before we get to 2 Samuel, I want to recap the events of 1 Samuel. And first and foremost, I want to cover this idea of the purpose of 1 Samuel. Okay? And we look at it and it's just a history book, right? It's the history of the people of Israel. The intention of the author of 1 Samuel, okay, which I think is Samuel and then others. We know Samuel didn't finish it because he dies before it's over, right? So he couldn't have written after he died. He's not that talented. And so the purpose of 1 Samuel is to show that David was not a usurper. The purpose of 1 Samuel is to show you that this is God's man, right? Because, I mean, if you're looking at this from the outside and Saul is continually pursuing David, you know, continually trying to take him out, and you'd think, well, David must be this, you know, this guy that's trying to take over the kingdom, and Saul's having to deal with it all the time, and ultimately, David wins out and takes the kingdom. Well, the whole purpose of 1 Samuel is to show you that that's not at all what David was trying to do. You know, David is anointed, and he goes out of his way not to be a rebel, not to usurp Saul, always honoring Saul, even though Saul's not honoring the Lord whatsoever, right? So the whole purpose of 1 Samuel is to show us that David is the legitimate chosen king of God, not this usurper. Because remember, what happened? Samuel was anointed, right? He was chosen. He was given the kingship. And usually when you're a king, your son becomes the next king. Well, that's not what happens in this case. David comes out of left field, sort of, and becomes king. Well, how did that happen? And in most cases, that would be a rebellion, a revolution. Well, 1 Samuel tells us that's not what happened. God rejected Saul, God chose David, and God orchestrated the events to make sure that David would be king, and David will ultimately be the one that gets all the promises. All right? Does that make sense? Any questions on that? Yep, Chrissy. It's a good question. I think it's an interesting interchange in 1 Samuel because it's the people clamoring for a king, and it's almost like he says, well, give them what they want, right? Let them see what it looks like when they choose their own king. And, you know, I know he chooses them, but we'll go through it when we go through 1 Samuel. But Saul is the most kingly looking guy in the whole place, right? Did you know Saul's the only character in the Old Testament that's described by his height that's an Israelite? It says he stands head and shoulders above all his peers, right? Kind of like me, except hopefully I'm not Saul-like. Think about every other character that you hear about that's described by height. Goliath, Og, you know, these evil guys. They're the pagans are always the ones that are described by height. Saul's the only one that's given a physical stature description. So there might be a little hint from the author there. You think about these early appearances of Saul. He's not exactly the hero. You know, he's a good king in terms of earthly things. I mean, he's successful, but he's not God's man. But yeah, I think the point is, I think he allows. Sometimes he gives you what you ask for, even though it's not the best thing to kind of teach you a lesson. Maybe there's something like that going on. Well, certainly he knows. I mean, you know, it's hard to understand the mind of God on that whole thing. But yeah, the ultimate scepter is going to Judah, and he chooses Saul out of Benjamin. You know, I'm not sure why that goes down that way. All right.
Well, and David, yeah. Saul's heirs are rejected also,
mm-hmm.
which is a little unusual. Actually,
yeah.
When you look at the history of Israel and Judah.
Yeah. It won't always be that way in the future. Yeah.
You know, son after son. So
yeah.
Are these children then rejected because they're lousy, or is it because Saul, their father, was lousy?
Yeah, I think it's mostly Saul. Because, I mean, Jonathan is nothing but noble.
Oh, that's right, Jonathan.
You know, so, I mean, it's not, Jonathan doesn't do anything to disqualify himself. Now, he's going to die, but that'll disqualify him. But, yeah. Yeah. But he has other sons, too. But, all right. So, I want to go through just a real quick chapter by chapter in 1 Samuel. Again, just kind of a flyby and cover what goes on in 1 Samuel and maybe jog your memory on some of these stories, and then talk for about 10 minutes on, if we have time, on 1 Samuel 31. All right? So 1 Samuel 1 is the birth of Samuel. Maybe you remember that story where Hannah and Elkanah are trying to have children, and they can't, and Hannah goes down to Shiloh to the tabernacle and prays for a son. And God gives her a son, and she says, I will give him to your service, right? God blesses her with Samuel, and Samuel will, as a young boy, be given over to serve in the tabernacle there at Shiloh under the high priest Eli. 1 Samuel 2 is Hannah's song, where she praises God for giving her the son. And there's a lot of parallels between Hannah's song and Mary's, the Magnificat of Mary in the Gospels, right, in Luke. So 1 Samuel 3, Samuel encounters the Lord. You'll remember that story where Samuel's sleeping and he hears the voice of the Lord, and he goes to Eli and says, did you call me? No, I didn't call you. And then by the third time he says, oh, that's the Lord. You go in and say, your servant is listening. And he gets a message from God. 1 Samuel 4 is the Battle of Aphek. If you remember Eli's wicked sons, the two priests that take the ark into battle. And foolishly take the ark into battle, and the ark is taken by the Philistines, and the runner comes running back to Shiloh to tell Eli, the high priest, who then falls out of his chair and dies. And because he was heavy. That's what it says. So apparently it was quite a fall out of the chair. And then the Philistines destroy Shiloh, and the tabernacle's destroyed, and that's the last time we'll see the tabernacle until David puts it back up. And so the Philistines take the ark in 1 Samuel chapter 5. Remember, they go and take it and put it in their temple right beside their god Dagon, and they come back the next day, and Dagon's on his face. And they come back the next day, and they put him back up, and they come back the next day, and Dagon's arms and legs are gone. And then they keep moving. The ark moves to three different Philistine cities, and everywhere the ark goes, the Philistines are plagued with rats and boils and tumors. And if you have a King James, it says hemorrhoids. Take that however you want to. But it's not a good time to have the ark in your town. And after about 8 months, the Philistines say, get this thing. And they're about to take it to another town. And the city's like, don't bring it here. Send it back. We don't want it. Right? Like, we understand. God wins. Remember? And they put it on a cart with some cows and send it up the Sorek Valley there to take it back to Israel. And eventually it goes up there, and you just picture it, people working out in the fields, and here come these cows towing the Ark of the Covenant up the valley, right? And the Philistines send it back, and the Ark is taken up to a little city near Jerusalem called Kiriath Jearim, to a man named Abinadab's house. I think that's awful pressure to have the Ark of the Covenant in your house, but it is there.
Better not have any idols.
Yes, exactly. And it's going to stay there for many years. And after that, the Israelites repent at a place called Mizpah, and in that same gathering in 1 Samuel chapter 8, the Israelites ask Samuel for a king, because the other nations have a king. We want to be like other nations, right? And Samuel says, Yahweh's your king. Yeah, we know, but we really want a king like the other nations, right? And then Samuel goes to God, and God says, give it to them, you know, if that's what they want, but tell them that these kings are going to take their sons and daughters, they're going to take their land, they're going to take their money, they're going to take their... it's going to be bad. But if this is what you want, then I'm going to give you the desires of your heart, right? Your wicked heart. Let's see. 1 Samuel 9, Saul meets Samuel. Do you remember what Saul was doing when he meets Samuel? He's searching for his father's donkeys. What a noble beginning to a kingly career. He has lost his father's donkeys, and he is searching throughout the countryside for it. And they go, hey, there's a seer here. Let's go talk to the seer. Maybe he'll be able to help us find our donkeys. And Saul is going to anoint, or Samuel's going to anoint Saul as king in the next chapter after that. And then if you remember when the battle's about to happen to fight the Ammonites in 1 Samuel 11, Saul is hiding amongst the luggage. He's not even ready to fight. And so the first two episodes we get of Saul is this moron who lost his donkeys and the guy hiding in the luggage, who's already been anointed at that point, and he's hiding in the midst of the battle. Okay? But they bring him out, and he goes up to Jabesh-Gilead and fights the Ammonites and actually is successful, wins a great battle. And so Saul's first act, official act as king, is actually very successful, wins this great battle and protects the Gileadites over there on the other side of the Jordan. In 1 Samuel 12, Samuel kind of does a farewell address, kind of retires from public ministry and goes back to the house for a little while. And he tells them, warns them, he admonishes them about what they're supposed to be doing, to be following the Lord, and obviously a lot like Moses did, a lot like Joshua did, kind of that farewell speech. 1 Samuel 13, Saul is fighting against the Philistines, where he wins another battle, and that's that foolish sacrifice where Samuel says, go down there and wait for me. And Saul just can't wait, and he goes ahead and does the sacrifice himself, which is totally against Levitical law, right? You need the priest to make that sacrifice. Samuel's not there yet. He gets impatient. He does the sacrifice, and Samuel admonishes him for it and says, you've done a great evil there. In 14, that's Jonathan's miraculous victory. Remember, the Philistines are right down the road from Saul's hometown. Saul is encamped in Gibeah. The Philistines are across the valley at Michmash, which is one of my favorite names of cities in Israel. Michmash, and there was a great battle there in World War I with the British, too, that they replicate Jonathan's attack on the heights, and they win a battle there against the Turks, too. So, but Jonathan, remember, goes with his armor bearer, right? It says if they come down to us, we'll know we need to go away. If they call us to go up to them, we'll go ahead and go, and the Lord will give us the victory, right? And the Philistines come out and talk a bunch of trash and say, come on up here and take us, and Jonathan's armor bearer go up there and kill all of them, right? And then Saul's sitting under his tree being all depressed back in Gibeah, and whoa, wait a second, right? And then Saul makes that that rash vow that says if anybody eats any, we're going to fast today. What a great thing to do in the middle of a battle campaign, right? We're gonna have our soldiers fast for the day. If anybody eats anything, they're punishable by death, right? And Jonathan, not knowing that order has been given, gets some honey on the tip of his staff and takes a bite of that, and then Jonathan is condemned to die, right? And Saul's about to kill him, and the people of Israel rise up and say, you're not going to kill him, right? That's ridiculous. You're not going to do that because they love Jonathan, okay? 1 Samuel 15, Saul's disobedience once again. Remember, that was the, when you go in, you destroy everything in this battle. And Saul, and Samuel comes up and says, Saul, what's that mooing I hear? What's that lowing I hear? I hear animals. And Saul goes, well, yeah, I killed most of them, but I kept the good animals back because we're going to make this great sacrifice to the Lord. And Samuel says, he doesn't want your stupid sacrifices. He wants obedience. Right, and that's where Samuel rebukes him, and the Lord rejects Saul as king. So in 1 Samuel 15, Saul has been rejected. He's still king, but the Lord has made the pronouncement that Saul is going to be rejected. Okay, 1 Samuel 16 is when Samuel is sent to the house of Jesse to see all of Jesse's sons, right? Goes through all the sons, and he says, is there any more? Well, there's David out in the field, the youngest one. We'll send him in, right? And the Lord says, that's the guy. So Samuel anoints young David, probably 15 years old or so at that point. And by the way, I've been putting the dates up there, but David gets anointed sometime between 1025 and 1020 BC. That's about where we are now. Okay. 1 Samuel 17, of course, David kills Goliath. He goes to take his brother's lunch, and here's the boasting of that uncircumcised Philistine, and takes great offense at it and goes down and fights. And Goliath is killed, and that starts the legend of David throughout Israel, right? They start singing the songs where Saul kills his thousands and David kills his 10,000s. It starts the jealousy. David and Jonathan have a great bond in this whole thing where they become great friends. Saul wants to kill David, and that bond between David and Jonathan will become important because Jonathan will again and again warn David and protect him and tell him to get out of town. And Saul will have conflict with his son because of that. 1 Samuel 19, David flees to Samuel and says, he's trying to kill me. Yeah,
go ahead. Sorry to go back for just a second. But, yeah. I mean, Jonathan has already experienced battle and all that. And you said David's probably about 15. Is Jonathan 10 years older than David or something? Because if that's the case, he could be more of a mentor type relationship too.
I think he's at least probably 15 years older.
Yeah.
Judging by how old Saul is at that point. Because at that point, Saul's been king for 25 years. So we don't know exactly how old Saul was when he became king, but if you do a little bit of math, I mean, Saul was a mature man, so he's got to be at least 50, right? And so Jonathan would be at least 25 or 30, I would think, by that point.
Because he's often trying to protect it.
Yeah.
And so that makes more sense to me.
Yeah, they're not a couple teenage buddies hanging out.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of times how it gets pictured. Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. So David flees to Samuel and says, I haven't done anything. I help him out. I'm loyal. I'm in his court. He's trying to kill me. And he goes to Samuel and tells him that. 1 Samuel 20, Jonathan warns David, that's the arrows, right? Shoot the arrows out into the field and let him know that it was time for him to run. And David will basically spend the rest of the chapters in 1 Samuel on the run from Saul. And he will not be able to be back in. Every now and then Saul will relent and say, oh, David, I'm so sorry. You're noble, I'm not. You're good looking, I'm ugly. You're smart, I'm stupid. Come back. But then 10 minutes later, he wants to kill him again. Right? Because Saul is a little mad. All right? So 1 Samuel 21, this is where David flees to the priest Ahimelech at Nob. Right? That's where he eats the showbread. He's given the showbread from the shrine there from the priest. And by the time Saul gets there, we'll get there in chapter 2, He's going to kill all those priests for helping David. David then goes down to Gath, to King Achish of Gath, a Philistine, and it says he lets it dribble into his beard, and he pretends he's crazy, and Achish is going to take him in. He's actually going to live with the Philistines for a little while. Then the next chapter is Saul pursues him. They finds out that David was at Nob, and then Saul commissions Doeg the Edomite to slay all the priests at Nob. So Saul has kind of gone off the deep end by this point. And in 1 Samuel 23, David leaves and flees to the wilderness. Okay? The wilderness of Judah, down towards the Dead Sea. It says he goes to the wilderness of Ziph, the Jeshimon. That's where he's going to be hiding out. And eventually, he'll go to the strongholds of En-Gedi. Right? We got excited Israel people over there. They went to En-Gedi. Yeah.
One thing about that fleeing to the wilderness that I didn't understand or appreciate until we were there. It sounds like they're way out in the middle of nowhere, and you wonder how he and his 600 strong men and so on, how did they survive? There's nothing to forage there. There is no food.
Right.
The Dead Sea doesn't have fish in it or anything.
Yeah.
But you realize it's not that many miles from Jerusalem.
Yeah.
He probably had guys going back, sneaking back into the populated areas and bringing food back out for them.
Yeah.
And that answered a huge question that was in my mind once we saw the topography there, the geography.
Yeah, I mean, you can stand on the Mount of Olives and see the Jeshimon. You can see the Dead Sea from the Mount of Olives. So that's where he is. You know, normally, it's the same thing with Jesus and the temptation in the wilderness. Every picture you see in these, we were reading the children's Bible to my kids the other day, and Jesus went to the desert. Well, not really. He's not out of Arabia. You know, that's not where he is. You know, he's in this. It's dry. It's desert like, but there's caves and all kinds of hiding places. It's not just this big flat desert. That's not where they're hiding. It's perfect for guys a small group that wants to hide, because there's so many caves. You know, you wouldn't be able to. And that's what's going to happen when he goes down to the wilderness here in En-Gedi. Okay. So 1 Samuel 24, that's when David spares Saul's life. Remember, Saul goes into a cave to relieve himself. What is it? Cover his feet. And David is in that cave. So he talks about that. That shows you how deep the caves are and all that. And they say, kill him. He says, no, I will not raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. He goes and cuts a piece of the end off of Saul's, you know, clothing. Saul goes back down. You see him climbing all the way back down. And then when he gets to the bottom, David comes out and says, could have killed you. Just so you know, I'm not here to kill you. I'm not against you. I'm your servant, right? And he shows him the, and you can imagine Saul down at the bottom in the valley going, wait a minute.
And how vulnerable.
You know,
I mean, and for him to be doing that particular thing.
There's not many more vulnerable
and
moments.
Saves your life. Yeah, the idea is that he's completely humble, but he wasn't.
Yeah.
So
he should be, yeah. 1 Samuel 25, Samuel dies. That happens in one verse. It's the most anticlimactic death of an important person in Scripture. It just says, Samuel 25:1 says, and Samuel died. That's basically all it says. All right. And the rest of 25 is Nabal and Abigail. You may remember that story where David comes out to and meets a sheep shearer named Nabal and says, your son David needs your help. Will you give us some bread and some food? And Nabal basically berates him and says, you know, you're a traitor, I'm not going to help you, da 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 da. And eventually his wife Abigail brings David the food, brings his men food, and Nabal, they discover Nabal the next night at his house with plenty of food and plenty of drink, getting drunk, and he doesn't wake up in the morning, and 10 days after that he is dead. And then Abigail will become David's wife. Okay. 1 Samuel 26, David spares Saul a second time. They find Saul's encampment, and Saul is asleep on the ground with his spear stuck in the ground beside his head. Like he is, you want to talk about sitting duck, right? All you would have to do is go, it'd do that same thing in Judges where they got Jabin there, okay? So he goes to the camp and then he calls over and he says, Saul, could have killed you again. Didn't do it. I'm loyal. And that's one of those times where Saul says, you're right, David, you're noble and I'm not. But then the next chapter he's pursuing him again. So it's one of those kind of situations. And then so in 27, David flees to Achish down in Gath again and stays with the Philistines. And then 1 Samuel 28, that's where Saul is in the Jezreel Valley, and we'll talk about that story in chapter 31, where he's fighting the Philistines, and he's so desperate that he goes to the witch of Endor to get some prophecy or oracle or whatever.
That's on the forest moon, right?
Yes, exactly. That, yeah, there's, he had to get through the Ewoks before he got there. But yeah. They, we're editing them out of this version because nobody likes them. Any Star Wars people? We got a reference to Return of the Jedi right there. All right. So, the Ewoks lived on Endor. It's a forest moon. And anyway. Saul goes there. That's where the ghost of Samuel rises up and condemns him. And that's a whole other conversation, but that happens. And then 1 Samuel 29, the Philistines go up to fight against Saul, and David is actually with them. And the other Philistine lords say, we don't trust that guy. We don't want him here. And Achish sends David away, sends him back south again. So, and then in chapter 30, while the Philistines are up in the Jezreel Valley, David goes back to a city called Ziklag, which is the capital city of the Amalekites, and he destroys the Amalekites and takes that city. Right? And so when chapter 30 ends, David's defeated the Amalekites and has a city, and he's sending spoil all over Israel. Says he sent it to Hebron and all these different places. Meanwhile, we're going to get to 1 Samuel 31, which is Saul up at the Jezreel Valley. Yeah.
What is David's motivation for attacking all? Like, does he see himself as king? Like, whose side is he on? What's he trying to do?
Well, I think he's just, I think anything anti-God, he's going to attack. And so I think, and the Philistines are a perfect cover for that, because the Philistines think he's raiding Israelite cities.
And he has authority to do this?
Achish lets him go. He's living under Philistine protection, and he thinks David, because Achish says, well, look, he hates Saul, he hates Israel, he's probably out there. And that's good for Achish, because he's a Philistine.
But David really, has what, his own reasons and his
yeah,
own agenda.
And David's doing his own thing down there while all that's going on. Yeah, it's all a big trick over Achish. Yeah. All right, so 2 Samuel 1:1 will pick up in David's life right after 1 Samuel 30:26. It says, when David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. So when we leave David, he's defeated the Amalekites, he's gotten all the spoil, and he sent it to Israel. Right? He sent it to the lords of Judah to benefit Israel at that point. And then we flash up to 31.
Public relations.
Yes, it's great marketing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's human resources and all that. So while David was destroying at Ziklag, Ziklag is way down here. It's probably covered up by this thing. It's down here. All right, so here's Ziklag down here. This is where David wins that battle. Way up here in the Jezreel Valley is where Saul is. Okay, Saul is fighting the Philistines way up there, which tells you, this is Philistia. Look where the Philistines are. Okay, that's way into Israelite territory. That's a problem. And one of the reasons why they're there is because Saul has been so obsessed with David that he's let his guard down on the other sides, and the Philistines have come that far north into the Jezreel Valley. Okay? So here's a kind of a topographic sort of thing. So maybe I just wanted to give you a picture here. Israel folks, there's our Jezreel Valley. There's our shaft of the arrow, the Harod Valley, and our little Arrowhead Valley. Okay, everybody see that? So the Philistines have come all the way up from way down here, right? They're like way down here, right? And they're all the way up here in the Jezreel Valley. So here's where they are. This is Jezreel. This little ridge right here is Mount Gilboa. Okay, that's Mount Gilboa. That is where Saul's troops are stationed. Right across that valley right here is the hill of Morah. The hill of Morah, Shunem is the city down here, and that's where the Philistines are. On the backside of the hill of Morah right here is Endor, which tells you that Saul, to get to Endor, had to go through Philistine lines to get there. How desperate was he to get a prophecy from the witch if he has to go through enemy lines to get there? Okay? So the battle is happening right here, right in this little valley right here. The next city we'll see is Beit Shan. Beit Shan is right here at the entrance to the Harod Valley. Okay, so this is where the battle is taking place in the Jezreel Valley.
Question?
Yes?
What is the mileage? Like, I mean, this map looks like, you know, a football field.
Yeah.
So how far apart are the two?
Half a mile?
Yeah, these are not far, yeah, mile tops. I mean, they're very close.
City, I mean, it's a small city then.
Yeah, in the ancient world, yeah, very small city.
And you said there's a city right on the other side of it?
Yeah, there's the Jezreel is where Ahab built his palace. It's right here on the edge of the valley, and then there's a city on the foot of the hill right here. And so they would have been elevated up the side of the hill a little bit. That's kind of what armies did in the ancient world. They positioned themselves on opposite hills, right? Because you've got safety because nobody's going to charge up a hill at you. But if you've got the fight you've got here, if you can retreat, you can get back up your hill and have some protection. So they always positioned each other on opposite hills. So they can see each other.
They're like Bedouin kind of people. They're not building like walled cities.
There's cities there, but at this point, the Philistines aren't from here, so they're they would have tents and all kinds of setup right there. Yeah. All right. How much time we got? All right. So we'll go quick through 31. So now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. So they're running back away out of the valley up the Mount Gilboa, and the Philistines are chasing them, and they're all dying on the mountain. Okay? And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malachi Shua, the sons of Saul. So all three sons are dead. The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, so he's hit by plenty of arrows. And he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. And thus Saul died and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men on the same day together. Okay? It is very Brutus and Julius Caesar. Okay? So Saul's three sons are killed. He's keenly aware of the manner in which the enemy prisoners are treated in the ancient Near East, right? You don't want to be caught by the Philistines or the Phoenicians or the Assyrians or anybody else. You're not going to be treated well. And there's no Geneva Convention. There's no prisoner of war thing here. Okay? So Saul wants to die. Why do you think the armor bearer refuses to grant his request? Why does the armor bearer run him through?
That's a moral dilemma, and that would be a violation of one of the commandments. I cannot kill you.
Yeah.
I cannot murder you,
right,
even though you're giving me an order, and I am a man under authority. I'm supposed to follow that order. That's a moral dilemma you cannot obey.
Yeah, I think the armor bearer is a pretty noble guy.
He was also anointed.
Yeah, and I think that's the other part, is does he know? Because all David's been saying is, do not raise your hand against God's anointed. Does the armor bearer know that too? Yeah, he probably does. Right. I'm not going to be the guy that kills Saul. That's not going to be me. And you're going to see in the next chapter the guy that's going to claim to have killed Saul and how David's going to react to him. Because the guy's going to come to and say, "Hey, I did it for him. He wanted to die, so I killed him." And David's going to say, "Oh, you did that." Now, he didn't really do it. It's a whole story. But David's not going to react well to that. So I think that's the point. So less than 24 hours earlier, the ghost of Samuel said, "Moreover, the Lord will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me." Okay? And Julius Caesar, the ghost of Caesar, comes to Brutus and says, "I will see thee tomorrow at Philippi. The Lord will give the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines." That comes true exactly. Okay? And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled. And the Philistines came and lived in them. So the Philistines now have control of the Jezreel Valley. The next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to their people. And they put his army in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beit Shan. Okay, so this tells you how much of a dominant victory this was for the Philistines. Because normally, when people were killed in battle, especially important people in battle, it was the responsibility of the others to get those bodies out of there. And so the fact that Saul and his three sons are still laying there the next day tells you there were no Israelites left to come collect the bodies. So the Philistines are coming through and stripping the bodies, and they find the king and his three sons. Right? Those would have been bodies you would have gotten out of there, because you know what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen. They're going to send his head around, they're going to send his army around, and they sling his body over the wall at Beit Shan, which is right down the road there. Okay, again, the bodies are desecrated. So we'll end here. When the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead, remember from chapter 11, basically what happens, real quick, the people of Jabesh-Gilead go and get the body from Beit Shan. They take a dangerous trip through the night. They cut the bodies off the wall at Beit Shan and give Saul a proper burial and his sons a proper burial. That's the same group that Saul came to save in 1 Samuel chapter 11. So it makes perfect sense that these guys would risk everything to get Saul's body back, and they do that. Okay? So that I say all that to set the stage for 2 Samuel chapter 1, where David will get word of this battle. Okay, that's how 2 Samuel chapter 1 starts, is David has won a great battle, everything seems great, and he's going to get word that the Israelites have been defeated, they've lost cities, they've lost land, and most importantly, Saul and his sons have been killed. All right, and we'll see how David handles that. All right, I can breathe now. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for, again, for the time that we have just to study these things that you've given us in your word. And I pray you bless the time that we have today in the service. Lord, bless Brother Aaron and all that he's got prepared for us today, and help us to make him feel welcome and bless him as much as possible for the work that he's doing over there in North Africa. And continue to bless his ministry, Lord. And we thank you for all that you do for us. Thank you for all that you give us. We surely don't deserve it. We love you. Thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks, guys. You are dismissed.